dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your kill of flesh, your fill of flesh.' After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, and that looked like a leopard. And on its back, it had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision of night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and all the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision of night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshiped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. I approached one of those standing there and asked him the meaning of all this. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The 4 great beasts are 4 kings that will rise from the earth. But the holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. Then I wanted to know the meaning of the 4th beast, which was different from all the others and most terrifying, with its iron teeth and bronze claws, the beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. I also wanted to know about the 10 horns and on its head, and about the other horn that came up before which 3 of them fell. The horn that looked more imposing than the others, and that had eyes and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the holy people and defeating them, until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the holy people of the Most High, and the time came when they possessed the kingdom. He gave me this explanation. The 4th beast is a 4th kingdom that will appear on earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from the kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from the earlier ones. He will subdue three kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress the holy people and try to change the set times and the laws. The holy people will be delivered into his hands for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. Okay, so we're going to get all of that fully explained. We can turn the lights up now. Many of us are old enough to remember, I'm kidding. Many of us are old enough to remember Rummy. Raise your hand if you remember who Rummy is. Donald Rumsfeld. He was the Secretary of Defense during the Gulf War, during the presidency of the first President Bush. Okay, and he was known affectionately as Rummy, affectionately by some, derisively by others. But it was after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and he probably wanted Kuwait mostly for the seaport that he could have there. But Saddam Hussein was actually trying to restore the empire of Mesopotamia, which included Iraq. I was wrong, Norwin. Norwin's asking about this. It wasn't Iran, it was Iraq and Syria and Kuwait. Were all included in Mesopotamia, but Babylon was in the middle of those, and Babylon is actually, there are ruins there that Saddam Hussein attempted to restore, and he actually built a palace outside the wall, what were the walls of ancient Babylon, but he also spent a lot trying to restore parts of the ancient city of Babylon, and you can go over there and see that if you can get there, but it's not inhabited currently because it was ultimately destroyed. But Betty, you may remember Colonel Demas, we should say. She's doing her class right now, but she spent a year or so in Kuwait. That was her last deployment because that war is probably very fondly remembered by the Kuwaitis. And we still have a major presence there because we drove the Iraqi invaders out and proceeded into Iraq, but just enough to make sure that they could not easily do that again. Well, during that invasion, this is the whole point, Rummy held news conferences every day and attempted to answer every question that was asked, or some questions that weren't asked. And whether people agreed with what was going on or whether they liked him or not, no one could deny that Donald Rumsfeld was really good at those news conferences. And one of his most memorable lines has stuck with me, and it's in the popular culture. I heard it quoted last week, in fact. He was asked about something that was very complicated or unexpected or unexplained, and he said, well, there are known unknowns, and there are unknown unknowns. In other words, there are some things that we know we don't know, and there are other things we don't even know we don't know. Well, the reason that I was struck by that goes to the heart of the problem that we humans have. Maybe you've used the phrase, as I have, I know what I know. You know, well, do we? Do we really? Well, we can know a lot of things within the limits of human ability to accept that it isn't always, you know, completely wrong to say that. It's only a major problem if we don't also admit it when we don't know something. The problem is that we often fail to remain humble enough to add that there are even some unknown unknowns. There are things that we know that we don't know, but there are other things that we don't even know that we don't know. Okay, when it comes to the Bible, or more specifically when it comes to God, which the Bible is revealing to us, it might seem like we need to at least believe that we can understand him, And we should live our lives trying to come to a more complete understanding of the Bible and of God. And I really believe that is true. But I believe that there is a profound irony that will inevitably keep us humble. Aristotle is quoted as saying, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. Probably heard that, maybe didn't know it came from Aristotle. Albert Einstein echoed that by saying, the more I learn, the more I realize how much I don't know. So a good question is, how much do we really need to know? And when we read Daniel 7 and other parts of Daniel, and when we read the book of Revelation in the New Testament, the last book in our Bibles, we encounter another irony. And they are both a special type of literature called apocalyptic literature. You've probably heard that. The apocalypse has come to mean the end of the world. But what it really means is the revelation or the revealing or uncovering of reality that already exists. So to cut to the chase, in the case of the book of Revelation, also called the Apocalypse, what is revealed is that Jesus, the Lamb, is on the throne. In spite of the evil that we see and we experience and even participate in, the evil one is not really in control of this world. Now, to us, the imagery in the book of Revelation may be more disturbing than comforting. But to someone who has watched loved ones being literally fed to lions whose mouths were not kept shut, like the lions in the den that Daniel was thrown into, you know, it would have a very different feel. Think about this. Try to put yourself in their sandals for a moment and think about what Revelation would sound like, what Daniel would sound like when you see these beasts that are being defeated. It might help you to feel a little bit better. Now, that being said, when Daniel saw these visions, he was not in the position of Christians in the first century. He knew nothing about Jesus and the way that Jesus overcame evil and overcame violence through voluntary suffering and sacrifice. He didn't know anything about that. He was as terrified as we would have been by these visions. And these visions were like very real nightmares for Daniel. So try to put yourself in his sandals for a moment. Think about that. Now, there are many things that we may never understand in Daniel 7 through 12. But, and I don't know how much more I'm going to preach. I may preach one more lesson. It may go on. But basically, I just wanted to get to the overall view of what Daniel 7 through 12 is about. But there are some things that we can understand in Daniel 7. And some of those things we can that we can understand can be encouraging in at least two ways. For one thing, we can see prophecy fulfilled in history in unique ways. And we see that through what is now history, but in Daniel's time was the future. More importantly, though, we can come to understand a little bit more about Jesus. Daniel 7 was actually a very important chapter to Jesus and to the first century followers in some ways. And that should make it important to us. So let's look first at the beasts and how their imagery was fulfilled in the hundreds of years between Daniel and Jesus. Now, first of all, the turbulent sea that it talks about, out of which the beasts arose, that represented the Gentile world to the Jews. It was the turbulent sea outside of the Israelite people. But also, we need to recognize that chapter 2 of Daniel is really parallel to this dream that Daniel has, you know, that Nebuchadnezzar's dream and Daniel's dreams. Really, we're talking about the same thing. In chapter 2, we saw this image that Nebuchadnezzar had made, it wasn't the image he had made, sorry. There was one that he had made that they didn't bow down to. But in his dream, there was this image that had the gold head and the silver chest and the legs of iron and then the feet of clay and mixed with iron. And those were the same kingdoms that were represented by the beasts in Daniel. I'm not sure how well you can see the images up there, but yeah, you can probably tell which they are. So let's look at this. Daniel said, "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lit, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. This was the kingdom of Babylon itself. And the lion with wings was the imagery that they used. We actually have some of the murals that were in the city of Babylon that have the lion image all over them. We have the bald eagle, you know, that represents the United States. Well, the lion with wings represented their strength and ferocity, okay? And then there before me was a second beast. Just look down those as we go, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, get up and eat your fill of flesh. This was the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, if you were here last week, we talked about Daniel, but the week before that, we talked about Belshazzar. Belshazzar was Nebuchadnezzar's son, who became king after Nebuchadnezzar, and he was not a serious person, and he was weighed in the balances and found wanting. And then at the very end of the chapter, we see that that very night, his life was taken. That was taken by the Medes, Darius the Mede. And this represents the Medo-Persian Empire. They were going back in time because this happened, remember, in the first year of Belshazzar. Chapter 7 starts out, this was in the first year of Belshazzar. Belshazzar is gone now, you know, after Daniel in the lion's den, because it was Darius that threw him in the den, okay? All right, so we're going back in time and to Belshazzar's years as king of Babylon, and he was weighed in the balances. He's found wanting in chapter 5. He was killed that very night, and Darius the Mede took over. And so that's the beginning of the Medo-Persian Empire. It came down from what is now Syria. And I'm not sure what the three ribs between his teeth were. There are different interpretations of that, but I think they were probably Babylonians who were devoured as Darius took over, Babylonian leaders perhaps. Okay, after that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back it had four wings like those of a bird. This beast had four heads, and it was given authority to rule. This was Greece under Alexander the Great. Now, when Daniel had this dream, the Medo-Persian Empire hadn't even come. So it was already a prophecy of Darius. Okay? And so that prophecy was fulfilled, was to be fulfilled when he had the dream. And then it was fulfilled at the end of the story of Belshazzar. But Greece doesn't come during Daniel's lifetime. But this is Greece under Alexander the Great. So the bear had not yet come during the third year of Belshazzar's reign, and neither had the Greek Empire come when he had this dream. And these were prophecies that were in the future and the distant future, but they were fulfilled in what is well-known history for us. All right, so the leopard represented the speed that was the hallmark of Alexander the Great's army. His army wasn't that big, but it moved very fast. And in fact, you know, they attacked and destroyed so quickly that in about 10 years, Alexander basically conquered and ruled all of the known world. And he only lived to 31 years old. And then the four heads represent the four generals that the Greek Empire was divided among. And so, again, a fulfillment of a prophecy that was way after Daniel's time. All right, after that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. The fourth beast was that was not compared to a known beast was the Roman Empire. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being and a mouth that spoke boastfully. Now, the little horn is an unknown, a known unknown, as far as I'm concerned. It's not identified in the same way that the other images are identified by the one that Daniel asks to interpret. And this leads to some, you know, leads some Christians down a very divisive road. The New Testament book of Revelation does have a similarly boastful figure in chapter 13, but I don't see any clear help really there to identify this little horn. Unfortunately, many sincere teachers have led many sincere Christians to believe that they can and they should identify this boastful little horn either in our world now or in the future or maybe in the past. Many say that it's the tiny kingdom of the Vatican, this tiny city, the smallest city in the world, but it actually has independence even though it's there in Rome, you know, but it has these claims of infallibility. Well, others say that it was Antiochus, or however you want to pronounce it, Antiochus, some say, the Greek general who took a fourth of Alexander's empire, the Seleucid Empire, the north of where Israel was, and he hated the Jews. He desecrated the temple. He was the one who sacrificed a pig on the temple altar and spread pig blood all over it, which of course was an abomination to the Jews. And he even required people to worship him as a god. He killed 80,000 Jews. Then others say that it's the Antichrist in Revelation who rules the world for a short time. Okay, I'm sorry, but as convincing as some of these teachers construct their arguments, they can make really convincing arguments for those various positions. But Daniel doesn't get that kind of clarity, and I don't think it's a good thing for us to think that we could or should have more insight than Daniel himself. But in some ways, you know, it could be all of those and other things that fulfill that in a certain way. But what we can and we should take away from these visions is the final outcome of all of the power grabbing, the oppressiveness of earthly governments, all earthly governments. Look carefully at what it says and what does not say, but put your faith in what it does say. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from the earlier ones. He will subdue 3 kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his holy people and try to change the set times and the laws. The holy people will be delivered into his hands for a time, times and half a time. There are different interpretations of exactly what that means. But the court will sit, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. Let me simply say that if Jesus comes to earth and sits on that throne for 1,000 years after a rapture and tribulation and renewal of the earth, as many people believe, but I don't. But it's perfectly fine with me if that's what he does. As long as he's ruling and I'm there. However, I don't believe that we have to believe that in order to be a part of it. See, that's the deal. I also don't believe that those who believe in the traditional view of the earth being destroyed by fire and then judgment followed by eternity in heaven or hell should say that every faithful follower of Jesus must believe that. So what we do very much need to believe is that Jesus rules now. And he will rule forever. And ultimately, in a more visible way, after all of the power struggles on earth and in spiritual realms have ceased. Many very sincere and good followers of Jesus get caught up in trying to identify details of Daniel and Revelation and other prophecies. And I do not believe that I can judge their motives, and I can't even say that their interpretations are all wrong. Some of them are coming up with correct interpretations, I suspect. The only problem comes if they believe that their interpretations are all correct, and if they spend so much time and energy on those things that they neglect to focus on what Jesus says is most important. He doesn't tell us that we have to understand all of the prophecies. He uses prophecies. He refers to prophecies. But if we get caught up in anything that distracts us from what Jesus said is most important, we are in real danger of losing our relationship with him. His judgment scene did not include a quiz on all of the Old Testament prophecies. When he pictured the judgment, it was very simple and straightforward. Did you give water to those who were thirsty? Did you give food to those who were hungry? Did you give clothes to those who needed clothing? Did you visit those who were sick or in prison? Those were his questions. And so interpretations are not as important as that. However, in verse 13, we do encounter a term back in Daniel 7 that was Jesus' favorite way of identifying himself. The term Son of Man. It appears only twice in the Old Testament, here in verse 13 and in Psalm 80. And in both cases, it identifies the one who rules with God. Jesus called himself the Son of Man all of the time, in all four Gospels. He didn't call himself the Son of God, or the Christ, or the Messiah. Others did that, and he didn't always correct them, or didn't sometimes correct them at all. I'm not sure he did. But once or twice, he did even say yes, that they were correct during his trial. But this passage in Daniel was very popular in Jesus' day as a prophecy about the restoration of the Jews to their rightful place as they understood it in the world. They were not supposed to be slaves in Egypt. They weren't supposed to be wanderers in the wilderness. They weren't supposed to be exiles in Babylon. They weren't supposed to be subjects of the Roman Empire. They were the children of God, heirs of a covenant between themselves and Abraham. They were promised the land that they had been taken from them when Nebuchadnezzar was used as God's instrument to punish their betrayal of that covenant that they had with God. But they were waiting on this prophecy to that God gave to Nebuchadnezzar to be fulfilled. And when the same prophecy was given to Daniel in another dream, this term, Son of Man, was used. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. And so this is where Jesus, this is what Jesus wants to connect to when he refers himself to himself as the Son of Man for the benefit of the Jews. Now, when Jesus called himself the Son of the Man, he could not exactly be accused of blasphemy. If he made an outright claim to be the Son of God, they could accuse him of blasphemy, and he was accused of that during his trial. But But he was the Son of Man, as far as the Jewish religious and political leaders were concerned. They didn't see him as the son of Joseph. But at the same time, they did see him as the son of Joseph. But at the same time, I think that they were bothered by his use of the term the Son of Man because of this passage in Daniel. So the significance of the message for us increases whenever our world seems darkest. One of our neighbors was talking with Brenda the other day, and she was just saying, this is a very dark world. Well, sometimes, you know, it certainly seems like a pretty dark world, doesn't it? And so when the world seems darkest and powers are most abusive, the prophecies in Daniel came true in visible, identifiable ways, and that supports our faith in Scripture and in the eternal nature of Jesus' kingdom and the fact that he's ruling now. So these prophecies were made hundreds of years before the Greek and Roman empires came into power and even before the Medes took over. But they did rise and fall as the vision said they would, and they had the characteristics that were described. So we can be confident, therefore, that the Son of Man came into power as well, and we should have faith that no matter what other goings-on appear to resist his rule, he is on the throne, and his kingdom will never fall. When and if we ever suffer in the ways that the Jewish faithful people and the first century Christians suffered, we will find more encouragement in Daniel and Revelation and all of the other things that seem more than a little bizarre in those few places where we read apocalyptic passages in Scripture. It was a very popular literary genre outside of Scripture. There are a whole lot of writings in between the New Testament and the Old Testament that are very similar in nature to this. But in the Bible, it's basically Daniel and Revelation where we find these passages, this literary genre. So some people love these images of beasts and violent battles, I guess. I'm not one of them, but notice that Daniel was also not one of them. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts. My face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself. So we can be honest and admit that these images don't really bring peace and serenity into our hearts, if you feel the way that I do. But we do have a great advantage over Daniel. We can see and know the Son of Man who has come and fulfilled these prophecies. We know that he is not like Nebuchadnezzar on steroids. I mean, Daniel might not have had an image of a ruler who would reign forever who was not a tyrant. In his mind, when he was told that there were all these tyrants that were ruling, that was all he knew. And so when he was told about this one that was going to rule forever, he didn't know that he wasn't going to be a tyrant as well. All of the rulers he had known were tyrants. Some were worse than others, but none of them were anything like Jesus. So it didn't comfort him to know that, you know, there was going to be this ruler forever necessarily, because he didn't know Jesus. Now, some of our candidates and elected leaders are worse than others, and some of them even aspire to be like Christ, but none of them are clearly any more successful than you and I. Some governments in our world are worse than others, and some aspire to, or at least aspire to allow and even encourage their citizens maybe to follow Jesus in their behavior. You know, originally, I think our founders had that in mind. And yet, the best that we can say, even for America, is that it's the worst country there's ever been, except for all the others. But do not be discouraged by the weaknesses and failures that you see in our leaders and in our laws and in our warfare. Instead, let those things draw us closer to Jesus and his kingdom. Separate us from the world. Let those things cement our hope in the only ruler who will never disappoint us. The rule of the Son of Man in Daniel was about one thing, and that was hope. Daniel was faithful even while he was in the middle of one of the most disappointing times that the Jews ever experienced. It was terrible. But he was, in fact, the only hero of faith, some say, about whom nothing negative is ever said or can be found in his life. You know, if Daniel could be thankful and hopeful even through all of that, we can surely be thankful and hopeful and actually go beyond that. We can recognize that we are victorious. We're on the winning side of the battle between good and evil before that's ever revealed. It's going to be revealed. That's what Revelation is all about, to be revealed. But all of the monsters have already been defeated, even if they don't yet know it. All right? And if we are faithful, we will stand while the fiercest monsters around us fall, whether they're monsters in our lives that are just attacking us personally, or whether they're big monsters that are represented by governments that are trying to and are oppressing others and doing evil. Let's pray together.